This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
I would introduce to you as an author of a few books, Conditions of War and Skylar Gabriel, and also talked a bit about the book you're working on now. And I'm wondering if we can just get right into it. Like, the vegetarian myth, to me, contains the most solid ecological critique of agriculture that I've come across, as well as a critique, of course, of, like, vegetarianism and veganism. And I like how you mentioned that living in an agricultural civilization is like living in, like being a fish in water, that is so ubiquitous, and we don't even think about it as pros and cons, what we get from it, and what it would even look like, or what it has looked like to live without these systems. And I think that's kind of like a confusing thing for a lot of people that I talk with. So do you want to just get into it and begin by explaining some of this, and perhaps explain why you started writing this book?
Sure.
Right on.
I will make a valiant effort. You know, as you mentioned, a lot of this information is going to be new to most of your listeners. Even on the farthest fringes of the environmental movement, no one is questioning agriculture. Like, they don't know how, and they don't even know that they should. So I just want to acknowledge that I'm asking listeners for something pretty big here. It's a leap that you're going to have to make, and that is bound to bring up some strong emotional reactions. It's a lot easier to evaluate what I'm saying if you can step back from the emotional response. And I also want to be very clear that the underlying values of environmentalists and vegetarians are not at issue here. Those values, like justice, compassion, sustainability, especially any critique of human hubris or human entitlement, those are values that I share very deeply. It's really the motivating ethic of my life. And those are also the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. So that's not the problem. Okay, the problem is ignorance. And it's ignorance about the nature of nature versus the nature of agriculture. Because those two things are completely at odds. One is actually a war against the other. So I'm going to cut to the punchline. You have to understand what agriculture is. In very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So it's biotic cleansing. And this lets the human population grow to gigantic proportions, because instead of sharing that land with millions of other creatures, we're only growing humans on it. So like a typical hunter-gatherer in my climate, in a temperate, your basic temperate climate, needs about a square mile to support herself. An agriculturist only needs an acre or two. That's because I'm not sharing it. So besides the fact that you've permanently displaced any number of species, and when I say that, we're really talking about extinction, okay? The real problem is that you're destroying the topsoil. And topsoil is the basis of life, or at least land life. I mean, I know the oceans have their own thing going. But if we're talking about terrestrial life, it's not possible without soil. So right about now, if you're actually following this, you should be getting a cold chill of horror, because we have to talk about overshoots. So William Canton wrote a book. It's called Overshoot. It's one of those books that everybody on the planet should be reading, like now. The book is over 20 years old, but it's even way more valuable now than it was when he wrote it. And he makes a distinction between takeover and drawdown. The takeover method is pretty much how nature works, in that every creature out there is trying to have their day in the sun. And I mean that pretty literally, in that the sun is the source of all energy for our planet. And plants are the people who can photosynthesize. They can take that sunshine, and they use that as energy to create life. We can't do that as animals. All we can do is consume. But every creature out there is trying to get more of that energy for themselves. So there's this constant struggle about who's going to fill which ecological niche. And eventually, you know, you have your moment when your species is really good at that, but another species comes along and they're better at it. So you fall off the ecological tree and they take over. And so that's just how it works. That's how life propagates itself. And there's nothing immoral about that. It's just how it works in evolution. So that's called the takeover method, because you're taking over a niche. The other method that species use is called drawdown. And a lot of writers, the peak oil writers, people who talk about, you know, resource depletion, they make this distinction about the year 1800, but that was when the drawdown method really came into existence with humans. And what we discovered in the year 1800 was fossil fuel. So suddenly there's oil, there's gas, there's coal. The Industrial Revolution gets underway. And what we're using is stored sunlight. The only source of energy on this planet is sunlight. And fossil fuel is stored sunlight. It's ancient drops of sunlight underneath the crust of the Earth. We figured out how to extract them, and we figured out how to use them. This is temporary. Okay, those forms of energy do not reproduce. The sun shines every day. Now, it's in limited quantities, but it's every day we get more. We don't get more fossil fuel. Once it's gone, it's over. These are non-replicating resources. And by using this, what we've done is temporarily increased the carrying capacity of this planet for human beings. But when it's over, we're headed for the crash. And that's really what nobody in this culture wants to face, is the fact that these are non-replicating resources that are not going to come again. Okay, so they make this distinction in the year 1800 between takeover and drawdown. And these are really smart people, and they're certainly courageous people. Some of them are even really nice people, but they're also wrong about this. And my point here is that agriculture itself is also drawdown. It was not just takeover. And what we're drawing down is fossil soil. And that's the concept that I want to insert into this dialogue. So to give you a number, one season of planting, your basic annual monocrop, so grain, right, wheat, corn, soy, whatever, one season of producing those can destroy 2,000 years of soil. So this is drawdown in a big way. And right here is the basis of our ignorance, because soil is not just insensate dirt. We can't just replace a few minerals and hope for the best. It's animate. It's animate past our wildest imaginings. One tablespoon of soil, I want you to imagine a tablespoon, that contains more than 1 million living organisms. So a square meter of topsoil, like picture a great big box, that can contain 1,000 different species of animals. And that might include 120 million nematodes, 100,000 mites, 45,000 springtails, 10,000 mollusks. Mollusks, you say? Aren't mollusks those barnacle things that attach to the bottom of boats? Well, yeah, that's what a mollusk is, but there's little tiny ones that actually live their entire life cycle inside drops of water in the soil. So there are oceans under your feet. And but the only template I have to get people to understand this is that Dr. Seuss book, Horton Hears a Who. That's exactly what's going on. There are these entire worlds beneath your feet. And those creatures are the ones that are doing the basic work of life, because they're producing and they're degrading. The people like us that are just animals, we just consume. We're not producing and we're not really degrading. You could have an entire planet that was just plants and bacteria. You don't really need us. So at this point, we've been around so long that we do have functions that are really necessary for the functioning of the planet, but you don't actually have to have us. So when we do agriculture, we're destroying all of that. And Jared Diamond, you know, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, mm-hmm. he said that agriculture was the biggest mistake the human race ever made. Toby Hemingway says that sustainable agriculture is an oxymoron, and I agree with them. I think this was a huge mistake, and I don't think that the human race is prepared at all to face what we've done by taking up agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So I can keep going. Do you want to insert anything here?
I think it's going in a great direction. I wonder if you can keep going a little bit more to talk about, like, how this is built up. Like, what, I mean, I think it's, and you're talking about, like, the basic functions of life within topsoil, but, and I think it's really, really important to get, because it's, and it's hard to imagine, it's intangible to many of us who don't really have a direct relationship with soil. Can you take it a little bit further?
Yeah, the next thing that people have to get is the concept of a perennial polyculture. So there's two words there, perennial and there's polyculture. Perennial means that plants live a long time. Now, obviously in nature, nothing's forever. But because they're perennial, it means they've got a really big, complicated root system, and they are the matrix that holds the soil in place. So without those roots, the soil just washes away. And the other half of that phrase is polyculture, and that means that it's a whole bunch of plants working together to create and protect topsoil. So this phrase, perennial polyculture, that's the phrase for the millennium. If we've got any hope for the future, it's because we help to restore those perennial polycultures. Now, nature creates a bunch of different kinds of perennial polycultures. It's forests, prairies, wetlands, savannas, tundras. Those are all different kinds, but it's the same template. You've got a whole bunch of different plants, all living a long time, and their basic function is to hold together the soil. Now, remember what agriculture is. You pull down the forest, or you rip up the prairie, and you destroy that perennial polyculture. And what you plant instead are annual monocrops. So an annual is the opposite of a perennial. An annual means they only grow for a brief season or two, and it's just long enough to produce a great big seed, and then they die. So with a monoculture, that's the opposite of a polyculture. And if you've ever driven through Nebraska or Iowa, what you see is miles and miles and miles of corn or soy or wheat. So instead of a dense community of plants and animals all working together to create more soil, you've just got this monoculture. So the soil isn't protected. It has to be exposed in order to plant those great big seeds. There's no roots holding it from below, and there's no cellulose protecting it from the top. And just like us, when soil is exposed, it dies. The sun cooks it, the rain compacts it, the wind blows it away. So what should be a habitat for millions of creatures doing that basic work of life turns into salt and dust. So I like to say that agriculture is carnivorous. What it eats is entire ecosystems. So to state the obvious, no culture that is destroying the basis of life can be called sustainable. I mean, really, it can only be called insane. Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets really strange, because it's those very agricultural foods that are promoted by environmentalists as the way to save the world. It's actually how we've been destroying the world. But it's like we want to save the world without ever knowing it. So anyway, we've run through every continent that there is, and that's the basic pattern of agriculture. It's the beginning of militarism, and it's the beginning of slavery as well, for the reason that it will never be sustainable. So you've got these power centers that arise wherever agriculture started, and they need a constant influx of new resources because they've overshot their land base. Agriculture creates a surplus. Because you have a surplus, that means somebody else can steal it. So the first thing that happens in agricultural societies is a class of people whose sole purpose is to be soldiers. So you've got the beginning of militarism. The surplus needs to be protected, but the surplus is also what lets there be an entire class of people who don't have to get food. All they have to do is fight. So now you've got a class of soldiers. The other thing that the power base needs is more resources, because they're constantly using them up. So the other job of those soldiers is to go out and get more and bring it back in. And the third thing that agriculture needs is slaves, because it's backbreaking labor. By the year 1800, when the fossil fuel age begins, three-quarters of the people on this planet were either living in conditions of slavery or indentured servitude. And the only reason that we've forgotten this is because we're using machines now to do that work. But believe me, when the fossil fuel runs out, we are going to remember just how much work is involved in this. So it's this feedback loop where agriculture creates the need for a military, and the military is made possible by the surplus of agriculture. And the entire system together needs to keep taking land, because it's forever using up its own soil. So over and over, you see these sort of boom and crash cycles all around the world where the power center arises. It's always based on agriculture. They've got to go out and grab more. Eventually, they use up the resources. Half the time, they don't even know why. They don't understand that the problem is they've used up their topsoil. They only know that there's less and less every year. And, you know, eventually there's a population crash, and then the whole thing starts all over again.
Mm-hmm.
We're out of continents on this planet. I mean, hate to be the bearer of bad news, but Atlantis is not waiting to be discovered. So by the year 1950, this planet was pretty well out of topsoil. All the major grain-growing regions of the world were about played out. And at that point, there should have been the inevitable population crash. And what happened instead was the Green Revolution. Now, Richard Manning has a fantastic book that's called Against the Grain, How Agriculture Hijacks Civilization. This is a phenomenal book. It's been really, really important in my work. But anyway, this is a great quote from him. He says, "With the possible exception of the domestication of wheat, the Green Revolution is the worst thing that has ever happened to the planet. Now, he says that because instead of the crash that should have happened, we had a quadrupling of the human population. Now, all of that was based on fossil fuel. When the fossil fuel runs out, we're only faced with the inevitable one more time. So the way that fossil fuel is involved here is a chemical process. It's called the Haber-Bosch process. And that's where you can make a usable form of nitrogen out of fossil fuel. It also requires a tremendous amount of energy to do this. So at every level, it's just more and more fossil fuel. At this point, if you're eating grain, you're eating fossil fuel on a stalk. You're not just eating fossil soil, you're eating fossil fuel. It takes the equivalent of 3 to 4 tons of TNT per acre for a modern American farm. Iowa alone uses the energy that would be in 4,000 Nagasaki bombs. Okay, so when I talk about this being a war against the planet, it's not just a metaphor. I mean it pretty literally. So the Haber-Bosch process was discovered by or invented by this man, Fritz Haber, who was German, and this was during World War I. Nitrates are necessary to make bombs, and at that point, Germany's supply came from Chile, and the British were able to cut off their supply routes in the Atlantic Ocean. So Germany had nothing to make bombs out of. Fritz Haber came to the fore and figured out the way to do this. He also developed poison gases, including ammonia and chlorine and Zyklon B, which is what the Nazis used. He won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1918 for the Haber-Bosch process. Then history kept rolling. It turned out he was Jewish, so by 1933 he had to flee Germany. And the story is pretty much everything condensed into one personal narrative, because after he had invented these poison gases, they were used by the German military in World War I, and he oversaw the very first gas attack that was ever done by human beings, and that was in 1915. He came home to a hero's welcome in Berlin, but his wife, who was also a chemist, her name was Clara Immerwahr, she killed herself. She committed suicide in absolute horror over what he was doing. And 2 hours after she killed herself, he rode back out to the front to do yet another gas attack. So then it's 1933. He has to flee the country. He ends up dead in a hotel room in Switzerland, alone and broken. A whole bunch of his relatives die in concentration camps, killed by Zyklon B, which he invented. And he had a son named Herman, who immigrated to America, who also killed himself in 1946. So there you've got it. You've got the racism, the misogyny, militarism, and the industrialization, right? Suicide, genocide, femicide, and ecocide, all in one pretty horrible little story. Anyway, Haber-Bosch, right. So we're going to run out of fossil fuel, too. I mean, this, again, is just the drawdown method, and we're about drawn down here. So we're facing the cliff, and that's really what nobody wants to talk about, even on the left.
Mm-hmm.
So, what would you like to add?
Well, I mean, like, one of the first things people who haven't encountered much of this, or, you know, even who have, will often say, like, well, what else are you going to do? How else are we going to feed ourselves? How else are we going to eat? You know, what do you say to that? What else is there? What about permaculture and stuff like that, too?
Right. Well, this is a quote from Lauren Cordain, who is one of the premier researchers on Paleolithic nutrition. So Paleolithic just means before the agricultural revolution. Anything since agriculture is called Neolithic. Okay, so Paleolithic. So this is what he says. We have wandered down a path toward absolute dependence upon cereal grains, a path for which there is no return. 80% of the food calories used to support the current human population come from annual monocrops. So without both takeover and drawdown, the human population would never have gotten this huge. Fossil soil, fossil fuel, fossil water, by definition, this is never going to be sustainable. What the planet needs is for us to help repair those perennial polycultures. Right? The planet wants to be a forest, wants to be a wetland, wants to be a prairie. If we simply get out of the way, those perennial polycultures will come back. And there will be a strong and resilient web of biotic relationships again on this planet. We can help make it happen faster. I mean, we could help the prairie return, put the buffalo back on it, but what we need to be eating is food that comes from within those living communities, not the food that's imposed across it. It's killing everything. The only way we're going to do that is to reduce our population dramatically and quickly. And I don't have any great ideas about that. I mean, honestly, we could do it if we were going to think about this rationally and make a decision as a species. I mean, we could decide that only 1 in 10,000 women gets to have a baby. Put your name in the hat if you want one. We do a lottery. All right, well, you're the lucky few. Go ahead. In 50 or 60 years, the population would be at a more reasonable level. We could keep that going for a few hundred years. Nobody would have to die, and it would be fine. But I don't see any evidence that people are going to do anything that's reasonable. So I think what we're headed for is something a lot uglier. But if you want to talk just personally about what we should be eating, yeah, I mean, there are, you know, some basic templates we can use to decide whether our food would, in fact, be sustainable. I mean, the problem is that nothing that we do is sustainable at these numbers. There's no way that the kind of repair of the planet that needs to happen, that's going to provide food for everybody who's here. We overshot 10,000 years ago, and we need to face that fact. But, you know, if you want, like, a list of, you know, sort of what to look for in your food, I mean, I can certainly provide those. It's going to be different from region to region. So you have to really know your bioregion to understand what it is you should be eating. But, you know, the basic question, does your food destroy topsoil or does it build topsoil? So if you're eating the deer that are eating the forest, that's sustainable. That could go on forever. If you live by a river and you're eating the fish that come up the river, that's sustainable. You know, as long as our numbers are within sustainable limits, that could go on forever. If you're eating grass-fed beef that's, you know, on pasture, not that's fed grain, but that's eating the real food that cows are meant to eat, that could be sustainable. It could go on forever. You're building topsoil year by year because the soil is protected by those perennial polycultures. So that's the first question. Does your food build topsoil? Does it destroy it? The second question would be, what kind of energy inputs are we talking about? If the only energy into that system is the sun, you're fine. Sun and ambient rainfall, that's it. So again, if it's deer in the forest and wild turkeys and some berries, you're good. That could go on forever until the next ice age. You're fine. You know, if it's grain that has to be fed with water that's being pumped out of an ancient aquifer and we're almost out of it, it's never going to work. If it requires damming rivers, destroying wetlands, which is what agriculture requires, it's never going to be sustainable. So, yes, on a personal level, we can try to, you know, make food choices that are really about repairing the world. But until we face this population problem, you know, it's just, you know, a personal lifestyle decision. It's not really facing the larger political problem that, you know, is sort of looming ahead of us. And, you know, the other thing I want to add to that is that I always feel like the only thing I have left is a moral exhortation to people, and I don't really feel like that's effective. What we really need is for, you know, broad base across the planet, all the institutions that are in charge of our society need to take this seriously and start doing something about it, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
can I quickly just ask you to address something? Like, actually, the person I'm interviewing in the next hour is talking about how sometimes the argument for population reduction by, like, certain mainstream environmental organizations can have inherent in it a racist argument or racism that places the blame more on poor women of color in other countries than of consumption of upper-class people and so on like that. Can you quickly address that point? Like, I think your argument, what you're talking about, is different than that argument. Can you just address that, though?
Well, we definitely need to incorporate that in, because anybody in an industrialized culture, just by existing, you're consuming a vastly greater number of resources than somebody in a poor country. And, you know, the industrial process is essentially just income shifting upwards to the very few people who are sitting at the top of this pyramid. But agriculture is a part of that process. I mean, you know, from the very beginning, it wasn't really about food. It was about who was going to be in charge. And those same people have been in charge ever since. So I think it is important to add that piece in, that, you know, if you're an American, you're using, you know, 33 times more copper and 120 times more, you know, what, you know, name the metal of your choice, and, you know, 1,000 times more water, and just on and on. I mean, we just have this glut of resources, and we're not willing to take a hard look at what this lifestyle is demanding from the planet and from other people. I mean, people are not a resource, they're human beings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I got this great quote from Richard Heinberg where he says, "It's difficult for many Americans to accept the notion that they should voluntarily give up their material privileges, their control of global resource streams, their entitlement to a glittering technotopian future of effortless abundance, and accept instead a self-disciplined and self-limiting future of hard work and parsimonious material aspirations. And that's what we need to be doing, and we're not.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can maybe take this in a slightly different direction. And, I mean, a lot of people talk about how patriarchy is also furthered or strengthened by, or required, I guess, by an agricultural civilization. Not that it creates it necessarily, but... So talking about that, like, given what you've been talking about and how it seems like there must be at least some degree of an unraveling of our system, you know, and this could affect, like, things like shipping of food from all around the world, like electricity production and oil and all that kind of stuff. And also, if that were to be affected or when that is affected, there's also, like, the social processes of control, like policing, schooling, mass media. And I've been thinking about disaster scenarios around the world, and there's always lots of examples where these situations lead to increased gender violence, which is, of course, another kind of social control. What do you think about all this, and what do you think people can do to alleviate the worst of it and deal with what we can't? And what do you think are some of the mental bonds which also contribute to our captivity?
Well, one thing is, right away, we need to start building and strengthening any kind of local participatory governments, wherever it is that we live. It would really help if people understood the crisis that's heading toward us and the kind of strains that civic society is about to undergo. If we took it seriously, we might be able to avert the worst of what could happen. But for those of us who understand what's coming, that's one of the most important jobs we can do. And this is one of those tasks that would be great for people who don't even want to discuss the concept of bringing down industrial culture. Okay, do this instead. Local government, local food networks, start a town meeting where you live. Now, I'm lucky because I live in New England, and where I live, we still have a living tradition of local self-government. Like, Vermont still runs by town meeting. We still have town meeting where I live. It doesn't actually have that much power, but we still do it twice a year. So we can learn how to do it. I mean, there's books about it. You can go and visit and learn just by observation. And even if you can't transform the government where you actually live into that kind of direct democracy right now, you can get the idea out there, and you can start practicing with whoever will come. So you can create a shadow government that's ready. But these are skills and concepts that we are going to need. And likewise, any self-sufficiency skills that you can learn and teach others. I mean, I get accused of being a survivalist. Well, I don't really want wacko Christian fascists to be the only ones left standing, because they are not going to create the world that I want. They're also going to burn me at the stake the first chance they get. But, you know, as far as the male violence picture goes, yeah, those are really ugly scenarios. Like, there's some war-torn areas of Africa right now where, I mean, statistics are just unimaginable. You've got 90% of the population has been raped by soldiers. And that's everybody, men, women, boys, girls, 90%. I don't even know how that society functions. Or, like, in Rwanda, if you survived the 1994 genocide, it's just assumed if you're a woman, you were raped, because it was just everybody. So as far as that goes, I think I've got, like, three levels of suggestions. And the first is physical, and that's that women need to learn to fight. And that's basic self-defense, like with weapons, with bare hands, bow and arrow, for when the bullets run out, slingshot, whatever. In some ways, it doesn't really address the problem, though, because women should be learning those things right now. I mean, there's already a war against women, and by and large, women are not fighting back. So why? Like, half the women in America will experience life-threatening violence at some point in her life. Battering is the most commonly committed crime in America. That's a man beating up a woman. But women aren't fighting back. So what we need to address are the psychological reasons why women don't fight. And that means confronting this mass denial, the psychology of mass denial. And that's basic to any oppressed group. It transfers really well to other oppressed groups. Like, I have this great quote from Harriet Tubman that I love. She says, "I freed hundreds of slaves. I could have freed hundreds more if they had but known they were slaves." And that pretty well sums it up. Dee Graham wrote a really great book that's called Loving to Survive. And she takes the idea of Stockholm Syndrome, which is what happens to people when they are in a hostage situation. And what we see over and over is that captives bond to their captors. And it's exactly the opposite of what you'd expect. You'd think for the rest of their lives, you know, you would hate these people who had done these things to you. But in fact, they bond to them to the point where, you know, if there's ever a trial, everybody knows they make the worst possible witnesses because they won't say anything bad about their captors. They go on to marry them. The captives will do prison support work for the rest of their lives. They form these incredible bonds with people who have held them captive. And we don't really understand why that happens. It's just fairly universal in something about the way, you know, the human brain works. Anyway, Dee Graham's point is that we can look at oppressive social systems and see them very similarly, that anybody who's in an oppressed group is living essentially in a state of captivity, and your life is always worth less. You are subject to all kinds of random violence. So you're in a very, and there's no way out. It's not like you can go somewhere else and be free from this. It's the world that we live in. So her point is that oppressed groups will have this same tendency to bond to their oppressors, and it's tremendously difficult psychologically to break through that and actually name the situation for what it is. I mean, I remember when I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I'm just going to say as an aside, I have a problem with how this man is held up as a liberatory figure. He was a batterer. He was a pimp. But back to Malcolm X, there was a whole paragraph of that book where I thought, wow, you could just take out the word black and put in the word woman, and you could take out the word white and you could put in the word men, and it would be exactly the same psychology. He's so clear about the identification that, you know, oppressed people of color can develop toward essentially their captors, toward white people. And I could see women's psychology was in there, you know, just as much. So there's this psychological piece that we all have to break through. And I also think that this really carries over to anybody who lives in industrial culture, because we're just as dependent on industrialization. And that culture, those processes are killing us just as strongly. I mean, it's killing the planet. And yet, we have this incredible loyalty to it, to the point where no one's even allowed to say out loud that that's what the problem is. So there's the physical thing we need to learn to fight. There's the psychological barriers that we have to break through. But the final piece of this is really political. You're only going to get so far on your own, right? We're only going to mount a response to this if it's organized. So women and our male allies could stop the kind of mass assault, you know, that does happen when civic society completely breaks down. But it's going to take that psychological courage to name the reality, and it's also going to take the political will to organize that. And it's going to take the forethought to say, like, yes, yeah, civic society is going to be facing some pretty traumatic things, and we need to be prepared for them. So I don't know if that answers your question.
That's a great answer. One more thing to do with these strains on civic society that many people are talking about and we can expect to face is, the common critique of people advocating for an end to industrial society or even just talking about how it may inevitably end. The common critique is that these people are ableist because their non-industrial utopia or whatever doesn't account for people who rely on wheelchairs or industrial medicines or people who are undergoing gender transitions or anything like that. I talk about that quite a bit with people, and I'm wondering what your take is on that.
Well, I personally have a degenerative disease, so I might not last long in a non-industrial culture. Like, it would totally depend on how much my loved ones were willing to do for me, because I'd be a burden in a lot of ways. Now, right now, most of those burdens are externalized because we all use fossil fuel. So I don't have to haul water. I can just turn on the tap. And I don't have to heat water. It's already hot. And I don't have to go out and gather all my food for miles. It comes to me in a grocery store. Most of my food actually comes from local farms. But, you know, I don't have to go get it on foot. I can use fossil fuel and collect it myself. But so, you know, this does have a fair amount of personal poignancy for me. I also feel like there's no point in shooting the messenger. Like, industrial society is going to collapse. Whether we like it or not, it's not sustainable. We are over the edge at this point, and that's not the fault of people who are pointing out the facts. I personally hope we make it through without abandoning our connections to our most vulnerable members, including the sick, the young, the old. I mean, that's one of the things that makes us human. But it is personally terrifying because I don't know what's going to happen to me. I know that if I was more dependent on machines or on medicines, it would be even more terrifying. I also know that most of us wouldn't be sick if it wasn't for civilization. I mean, nobody talks about the diseases of hunter-gatherers because they don't exist. I mean, by and large, they don't have chronic, degenerative, and autoimmune diseases that are ubiquitous among the civilized because of the food we eat. That doesn't help me in the here and now. My body's already been altered and damaged, and I'm more or less dependent. But I don't know what else to say except that, you know, the next 100 years are going to be really harsh. And my own ultimate loyalty is to my planet and to the life support systems of those biotic communities. And I'm ultimately glad that this is all going to come down, because what matters is the planet. But I don't know what it's going to mean for me personally.
Mm-hmm. So at best, we can stock up or learn skills to help us.
Yeah.
I'd like to quote something written, or is from a statement of purpose from a conference you organized.
Right.
And I'll just share this and maybe ask you to comment on it. Industrial culture is not just a way of thinking, an intellectual habit, or an emotional experience. It's an interlocking set of institutional power arrangements based on exploitation, violence, and the objectification of living beings. Changes in our individual and collective consciousness are essential, but they're not enough to bring this system down. We need organized political resistance. This culture cannot be reformed to one of justice and sanity. It is defined by destructive and oppressive systems of power. To create a liberated world, it must go. The hard truth is that all our efforts to encourage the dominant culture to voluntarily adopt sustainable ways of living have not made a significant impact. Do you want to expand upon that and maybe expand on where to go from here?
Right. Well, my mom always complains because I don't teach history in the public schools anymore. And my dad rolls his eyes because I don't teach science in the public schools. And my sister gets upset because nobody gets art anymore in the schools. And me, why aren't they teaching revolution in the public schools? Mm-hmm. So this is basic political philosophy, right? I think it's really crucial to understand the differences between liberalism and radicalism. And there's two main differences. The first is that liberals are idealists. So they see the crucible of social reality is in the realm of ideas. So it's concepts, language, attitudes. So liberalism is also very individualist. So it's all about personally changing how you think. Okay, because the basic social unit is the individual, and because reality is essentially a mental event. Now you got to contrast that with real radicalism, which is materialist. So radicals see society as composed of actual institutions. So economic, political, cultural. They wield the power. Okay, and it also includes the power to use violence. They're the only ones who have that legitimate power in this society. And the basic social unit is class or group. So it's racial class, sex caste, economic class, whatever grouping. So radicals understand oppression as a group-based harm, and it's also about concrete institutions. So liberals think that it's all a big mistake, and if you change how people think and if you change their attitudes, you will have a new world. It's really different than what radicals think, which is that we have to bring this down brick by brick. And the problem with the left in this country is that there's this tremendous pull to be more individualist and to be more idealist. So we've come unhitched from any notion of actually being effective, and activism in many ways has turned into one big group therapy session. It doesn't matter what we accomplish. What matters is how we feel. And this also leads into the kind of hyper-personal purity thing. If we're not actually going to effectively have organized political resistance, all that we're left with is changing our personal lives. So there's this intense hyper-scrutiny on what you eat and what you wear and where you buy things. These are all simply lifestyle choices. None of that is going to bring down the system that's destroying the planet. The task of an activist is not to negotiate systems of power with as much personal integrity as possible. It's to dismantle those systems. So personal psychological change and personal lifestyle changes, choices aren't going to change the global arrangements of power. And that's the problem. And that's what I'm getting at in that quote. And the left in this country has pretty well rerouted this idea. So we don't have political change anymore. All we can aim for is personal change. I think there's two people who find this appealing, two kinds of people. The first are basically spoiled and self-centered, and we can just ignore them. But the other group, I think, has a great deal of information about the situation that we're in right now. but they're in despair about it. And they're desperate to do anything. So when the left comes along and offers them, look, if you buy this product, if you change your light bulb, if you drive this kind of car, if you eat this kind of food, it's easy to take that out because we don't know what else to do. And there's a more radical, version of that, which is you can dumpster dive, right? So instead of buying stuff, you're going to do, you know, these other kinds of dropout cultural kinds of things. There's still just lifestyle choices, though. None of that is actually directly organizing against the power structures. And that's why they'll never be effective. So how do we change the world? Well, political action, ultimately. It's about force. And we have to face that. Now, force can, there's all kinds of different tactics that come under this rubric of organized political resistance. And we all have to make our own decisions about what we are willing to do, morally, physically, you know, what appeals to our talents and our skills. And I'm not here to tell other people what they need to be doing. And on that level, there's so much that's wrong, there's almost nothing you can't do. But that's pretty much what I'm getting at with that quote, is that we need to really understand the concrete systems of power and what we're going to do to dismantle them. Because what's at stake is our whole planet. And I want everybody to feel that emergency as deeply as they can, because it's the only thing that's going to motivate us to do something.
Thank you, Larry. Do you have any closing words? If you do want to wrap anything up from, like we began talking about agriculture and civilization, some fundamental precepts, and we came all the way to organized resistance, and in the midst there we talked about patriarchy and self-defense and all kinds of stuff.
You know, there's two places I want to end. One is I just want to reaffirm that we all need to hang on to the concept of universal human rights as long and as hard as we can, because when things collapse, that's the first thing to go. When people are starving, that's what they forget. And so in every place in our lives, wherever it is that we move, whoever it is we talk to, that needs to be at the forefront of our minds, always. Especially if we have any contact with children, that's what we need to be telling them. Universal human rights, okay? That's an amazing moment in human history that we came up with that, and we need to inscribe that in every single thing that we do between now and the end of the crash so that we can hang on to it. So that's like the big picture. And I want to thank you, Matt, for reading my book, for responding so well to it, and for inviting me to be on your show.
It's been a pleasure there.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.